This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2010 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. John Winslade and Lorraine Headcate to discuss their book, Remembering Lives, Conversations with the Dying and Bereaved. Lorraine Headcate is a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in working with people who are dying and their families after the loved one has died. She has worked with hospice and regularly teaches nationally and internationally about death, dying, bereavement, and narrative therapy. Her articles have appeared in numerous professional and trade publications and newspapers. Her recent children's book, My Grandmother is Always With Me, is co-authored with her daughter, Addison. Dr. John Winslade is a professor and coordinator of educational counseling programs at California State University, San Bernardino. He was previously director of counselor education at the university in New Zealand. He has a particular interest in how narrative and social constructionist ideas can enhance the resourcefulness of people and of communities. In addition to Remembering Lives, Dr. Winslade is the co-author and author of several other books on narrative therapy and narrative mediation, as well as many articles and book chapters. He conducts numerous workshops and made conference presentations on narrative practice in the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Cyprus, Israel, the UK, and Europe. Welcome, John Winslade and Lorraine Headkey.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Okay. Thank you, Rebecca.
Hey, John.
It's wonderful to have you here today. Thank you for joining us to discuss your book. One of the things I said to John is that I love that the book isn't really long, so it's not difficult to read this book, and it doesn't take a lot of time, so I really appreciated that. The first question that comes to mind for me is, how are remembering conversations different from conventional grief counseling?
That's a good place to start, Rebecca, that, because remembering conversations are very different from the way grief counseling or bereavement counseling has been thought of in the most recent past, certainly how most counselors think of it. Remembering conversations grew out of the narrative therapy field. That really works at looking at how relationship continues in a story form after somebody dies.
Can I just interrupt you for one moment? If we have a listener who doesn't know what the narrative therapy field is, what might you tell them about that?
All right. John, you want to help me with this in terms of putting this in a context?
Sure.
Thanks.
Well, narrative practice in therapy and in community work developed in Australia and New Zealand first, and then has spread to many other parts of the world. And it's predicated on the idea that people generate their lives, their communities, their relationships out of stories, and that those stories are formative and constitutive of who people are and who they become. And so it's a practice that aims at working with stories, sometimes to reauthor stories which people are experiencing as problematic. And in this context, what we're talking about is the stories that shape people's relationships with someone who is no longer alive, and those stories are shaping of their memories of that person and also of their ongoing sense of connection with that person after they die.
Thank you so much. And Lorraine, please continue.
Sure. That's helpful to put that in context.
Yes.
Following up then with what John is saying is that we're a remembering conversation will tap into those stories that were certainly available when a person was alive, and that they will continue to be accessible after the person has died, but they're accessible through different measures. For example, that they might be accessible through the stories that we carry with in terms of memory, in terms of legacy. So that the focus that we would be working with would be looking on what parts of the relationship do we want to maintain and continue after a person has died in a very different form. But there's places where we can continue to kind of underscore and highlight the relationship, or even what places do we want in a relationship to flourish and grow after a person has passed. that distinction is very different from conventional grief counseling that has focused on conversations of saying goodbye, closure, completion. And what we're looking at is the other side of the coin on how do we have conversations that are about reinvigoration and saying hello and holding the connection close. So the relationship in a remembering conversation and remembering practices is always the focus, the relationship between the person who's living and the person who has died. And again, that's very different from conventional grief counseling that is focusing on the internal experience of the grieved person and treating it as if it's an individual phenomenon, as opposed to looking at the relational aspect of the conversation and the connection. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of a starting point.
Yes.
Can I add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you want to add some things into that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that conventionally we tend to think in the modern life that biological death is the reality that the psychological experience needs to kind of align itself with, and therefore people need to accept the reality of the death and sever the relationship with the person because the body is no longer there. However, it is not hard to see that many people carry with them, long after someone dies, the echoes of the words that the person has said, the effects of the connection with that person, memories about someone who is no longer alive, and all of those things, in our viewpoint, actually constitute an ongoing connection with the person, rather than thinking that that is severed and has to be said goodbye to, and has to be, we have to align the psychological reality with the physical one. So we would argue that, you know, people don't actually die psychologically in the same moment that they die biologically.
There must be a lot of consciousness raising you do with your clients, because I remember being a brand new counselor and I was working in a private practice, and I remember a woman came in and said, I want to know exactly when I'm going to feel better from my husband's death, and I want to get closure. And I remember thinking, wow, she really thought it was going to be, there was going to be a neat answer to that. Do you know what I mean? Is that particularly in our culture something you ran into a lot?
Most definitely. That happens a lot in counseling practices, and certainly the calls that I get at the hospice where I work, where people's experiences are being shaped and informed by the dominant discourse of how grief and bereavement is thought to be. And that includes that idea of setting up a series of stages people need to go through to reach this magical endpoint where they're not going to hurt anymore. You know, and I honor the desire behind that people mm-hmm. are telling me that they're hurting and they don't like that, you know, and they want a different experience. But when we set up that assumption that if you properly go through certain stages or tasks in a prescriptive manner, that someday that pain is going to be completed, I think that we actually are creating more injury than doing good. Because the reality is that people may have ebbs and flow of missing or yearning that may last a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And for me, in a remembering conversation, it's finding ways to manage that through bringing the relationship closer rather than pushing the relationship further away.
I'm sure there's certain assumptions on which remembering conversations are built. What might be those assumptions?
But hey, that speaks to one of the first assumptions for me is that the relationship continues long after the physical presence is no longer here. So that death does not end the connection. Mm-hmm. Death does not end the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. And that we can find that connection through the experience of reinvigorating the stories, the memories, finding purpose in that, finding legacy in that, and having that be a solace to us in the face of very, very difficult times. Mm-hmm. So one of the strong assumptions I make is that the relationship continues to be accessible, although it is accessible, obviously, in a very different form. I cannot call my deceased mother, for example, and ask her for her recipes, right? Mm-hmm. And define that through another way, mm-hmm. right? But that using her recipes may continue to provide a place of comfort for me, you know, as I imagine her with me as I'm, you know, baking a pie, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And
I would add that one of the things that I would argue is the purpose of a counseling relationship with somebody is to help them form a way of going forward with their lives.
Mm.
And conventionally that has often been assumed, it has often been assumed that in order to do that, people need to sort of vent a certain amount of emotion and express it in order to actually kind of get rid of the grief and to hopefully reach a point where they separate mm-hmm. from the person who is no longer alive and say goodbye to them. We would argue that that's actually not necessarily as helpful as it has been claimed, and that actually what's more useful is actually for people to find places of sustenance in their sense of memory and remembering of someone who's died, and that kind of ongoing connection between stories from the past and stories that are being created and forged in the present and the future is actually more helpful for people in forming a direction for their own lives.
So grief counseling then would not be about accessing the stories of loss and sadness or the tragedy in the death. Although those pieces may be there and that we don't want to be dismissive of them, that it is about much, much more than that. It's about finding the places of relationship that may be about joy and laughter and the things that we were given during the course of the relationship and where that person has been in our life and where they will continue to be.
And sometimes requiring people to say goodbye to someone actually make things worse, make things more difficult and more painful.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Is there an appropriate time to engage people in remembering conversations? For example, might it be better 6 months, a year later? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think there's a misnomer that happens around grief counseling is that people have a certain requisite number of tears that need to be expressed or released before they can rekindle the relationship, or as Bill Warden would talk about, relocate the relationship. That is tacked on as an ending point after we've already severed the connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that seems like going about it in a backwards fashion. I would say that some of the best conversations that I've had with people, remembering conversations, have been at the moment their loved one has passed, and I'm sitting having a conversation with a spouse in the presence of their loved one's deceased body, and having conversations with them about, what is it that you want to hold dear about this connection? What is it that this person wants you to do right now? How is it that they want you to honor them right at this minute? And that produces places of strength and resiliency and right at the moment that the person passes, as opposed to saying, you know, you need to say goodbye so that you're not going to create some kind of emotional scar that you'll have to deal with later, and then 6 months from now that we can talk about what you want to hold on to. So I would really not argue for a lapse in time before remembering conversation can take place. That would be investing in much more of a conventional way of thinking about bereavement counseling. Does that fit for you, John?
Yeah, I was wondering whether you're going to also talk about those kind of conversations before somebody dies.
Mm. Oh, yeah, most definitely. Back when I was working in hospice as a social worker, working with people in more of a kind of that direct practice before somebody dies, that would be one of the things I would really enjoy about meeting people before they died, and I would talk with them about those kinds of conversations, that I would be asking them in the presence of their loved ones, you know, how do you want to be remembered? You know? What stories of your life do you want your family to uphold and honor and notice if you're no longer here to speak those stories? And who do you want telling them? And what rituals do you want to be enfolded if you're no longer here? And then most importantly, what difference will that make to you now facing death? as you know that your family, that you matter for your family, and that you will continue to matter even if you are no longer here physically. So the remembering conversations are not just an experience that we have with a bereaved person, but they're actually therapeutic for people who are dying, as well as looking at how we start setting up that map on where that connection is going to live.
I can give an example of that. My mother had a birthday, and we went out for lunch with her shortly before she died. And she, in a moment of just quiet reverie in the middle of the lunch, she asked, you know, will you still remember my birthday after I died? And I actually announced this request of hers at her funeral, and we have continued in our family to have kind of connections and celebrations of her birthday since she died, and that was at her request, which wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't been thinking in those terms.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, this really does represent a paradigm shift from bereavement and grief counseling as we think of it, which I think is wonderful. But I was thinking there are certain people, and my father was one of them, who they were so unique and so interesting that they're continually quoted after they
mm-hmm,
die.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father, who was a sharecropper from the South, had very little education, but had all of these great sayings, you know. And so me, my three siblings, and the 13 grandchildren, you will often hear all of us saying, you know what Papa would have said. You know,
mm-hmm. Right.
It's interesting
right.
because every time that happens, and it happens every time I'm with one of the grandchildren or one of my siblings, every time that happens, I say to myself, Papa's alive.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, yeah. And it's very heartwarming, isn't it?
Yeah.
When those moments happen that where we notice not just your connection to him, but that we notice how his connection has lived on with some, perhaps the grandchildren who had very little physical remembrance of him.
Right. Right.
But that he has a place in their lives, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I love those moments, you know, that they just, they're goosebumpy moments for me that you know, where I say we have not wasted those beautiful stories with your dad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can I just add to that? We were talking before about how remembering conversations can happen, you know, before someone dies or even close to the moment of death. But they can actually, I believe, continue to happen, you know, for many, many years. And often to our memories are things that are not just kind of photographic, indelible images. They're actually constructed as we go through life. And often as we encounter new things in life, the sense of what we remember about someone and their lives and how they contribute to us might well shift and change. For example, sometimes people have the experience of, you know, having a new baby, for example, and come into a family, and then suddenly their deceased parent has a new role to play as a grandparent.
Okay.
And can be remembered for the things that they would have said and done, even if we can't know exactly what that would be, we can imagine it, and in that sense keep their experience available to us to learn from and to grow through and to incorporate or fold into our own sense of ourselves or our own story of our own lives.
Mm-hmm. Can I tell a really quick story about that?
Please do.
This last year, my daughter learned how to drive. And
mm-hmm.
As I was teaching her how to drive, I was telling her stories about what it was like when I learned how to drive and how my mother had taught me to drive. And my mother was really insistent on, you know, being a what she called a defensive driver, and how my mother used to always say, you know, that there are, you know, lots of idiots out there whose goal is to kill you, and so you always have to be aware of this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was telling my daughter about these stories. Now, my mother has been dead, you know, for many, many, many years, long before my daughter was ever born. And when my daughter went to take her driving test, the woman, after the entire driving test and she passed the test, the woman who was testing her, they're sitting in the parking lot in the car together, and the woman, the driving instructor says to my daughter, now look, here, you know, you've done well, but I want to tell you that there's a lot of people out there who don't have your best interest in heart.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter interrupted her, and she said, yes, my grandmother's already explained all of this to me, that there are a lot of idiots out there on the road.
Oh. Wow.
And the woman... Right. The woman says, I love your grandmother. Now, all of this was spoken as if it was in the present tense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There was that the woman
so
from the DMV,
yeah.
as if she were alive, that she the driving instructor did not understand that my mother, my daughter's grandmother, is actually deceased, but that the story was so powerful that it transcended a generation and had meaning for my daughter and hopefully is making her a better driver out there as well. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So these stories are places where we can continue to fold them in as new events happen.
Yes. Recently I was visiting one of my brothers, and he has a brand new grandchild. So I was holding the baby on my lap, and she was very playful. She was grabbing my hair and the buttons on my blouse. You know, she just wanted to play with everything, and she was just adorable. And I looked at my brother, who said something like, wouldn't Papa have loved to play with her, you know, because he loved to play with babies. And I thought, here he is. He's here again.
And I would even, Rebecca, want to take that one step further and say, what would you and your brother want to make sure that this lovely little baby knows about her grandfather? What stories are going to be, you know, the most important to make sure that she's aware of, or which stories do you want her cousins telling, you know, about the great, you know, phrases he said and those kinds of things,
That's an example of the kind of question what Lorraine just asked that would actually grow a remembering conversation and grow a sense of somebody's identity as they figure out an answer to that, because it's not an answer that's often ready-made. It's not one that you just search within. You actually have to create an answer to it. And as you create it, a link is made, an identity link, a relationship link, and a generational connection is made in that moment of answering that question. And I think that's actually a very therapeutic thing to do, to ask questions that help grow such links.
That reminds me of the whole idea of membership in your book. And can you explain the idea of membership and how it relates to grief counseling?
Sure.
Shall I pick that up, Lorraine?
I was going to say that would be really helpful if you wanted to start that off.
Okay.
Well, really it owes a debt, this concept, to the anthropologist Barbara Meyerhoff, who did some wonderful creative work in her study of an elderly Jewish community in Venice Beach in Los Angeles. And after one of the members of that community died, she noticed how the rest of that community actually formed a stronger sense of their identity around their connection with this woman who had died. They actually got quite angry about some things that were happening in their neighborhood and formed a protest march along the beach, which got taken up in news events and became a documentary that Barbara Meyerhoff actually won an Academy Award for. But it's called Number Our Days. But the concept that she developed was that identity was very much linked to the stories of belonging to a membership club or a membership association or a sense of community or something like that.
Or an affiliation,
yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is slightly contrary to the usual ideas of identity, which are much more individualistic and about centering on the individual inside themselves and knowing themselves better. It's more about kind of knowing how I belong and how I connect with other people who are significant in my life, which includes family, but it goes wider than family. So this idea of membership club was actually picked up by Michael White, who has really popularized some of Barbara Meyerhoff's ideas in the narrative therapy literature.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote an article which picked up this idea. His original article was called Saying Hello Again, as opposed to Saying Goodbye. Mm-hmm. And he's talked about the concept of a membership club in life, or an association or an affiliation, and a sense of who we are as people is very much connected with, you know, who we belong to and who are the members of our club of life, if you like. And the concept of saying goodbye sort of suggests that we should cancel somebody's membership in that club of life, if you like, after they die. But remembering conversations really are about the possibilities that grow out of holding somebody's membership in a membership club long after they have died, And there are many cultures that do this. It's actually Western European culture has been in some ways unusual in its effort to sort of help people separate from those who are no longer alive. There are many other cultural traditions that actually have always valued this and keep people alive. I come from New Zealand, and with the Maori culture, people are never kind of, the ancestors are never far from people's lips and are always considered to be very present, for example.
I would say actually that there's many Western European cultures that secretly do this, but have a fair bit of doubt about whether or not that that's okay because of the overlay of the Westernized psychologies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and, and the other concept that comes in there is the concept of status and rank, because not everybody in our membership club of life has the same sort of central intimate status. Others are more peripheral.
Right.
And that becomes useful sometimes when thinking about after someone dies, you know, what kind of place do we want them to have? You know, do we want them to maintain a position of pride of place, or do we want them to remain more on the periphery of our membership club.
Can I just add in terms of connecting that to grief counseling too, that one of the places that this idea of membership frees us is in knowing that story does not exist exclusively within the individual, but it actually exists in relationship and between individuals and lives in the space in membership clubs or within affiliations, if you will, and so that when a person passes, their stories are not taken with them, right? Mm. Those stories are continue to be available within those affiliations, right? And that gives us many places to keep the relationship alive.
Absolutely. I was thinking of several years ago, I worked for as a subcontractor to the Army in Korea, and my family and I moved to Korea. And one of the things every year, there's the biggest celebration in Korea is the day everybody takes off work and they dress in traditional clothing and they go and put rice cakes on the graves of their relatives. And it's interesting because it's a day where it's the national holiday where everybody stops and they take these rice cakes and they remember their relatives. And we don't have anything like that in Western culture, do we?
Right. Yeah. We have some memorials that are often focused around legacies of war, you know, like Memorial Day or Veterans Day, where we honor people who have died in kind of that heroes mythology or battles. There are many other places around the world that do have public days of noticing where we fold, notice the connection and then fold it back into our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, that might be a time to reintroduce somebody into our lives or to introduce a newborn into a person.
Here in California, we have a very strong Latino community, especially Mexican families, who have a very strong tradition of the Day of the Dead.
The Day of the Dead.
Okay. I just wanted to mention one other thing about remembering in relation to membership clubs.
Sure.
If we think about membership club and think about people as being members of the club of our lives, then remembering is more than just the cognitive sort of reminiscing, for example. It's actually an active process of folding people into that membership club in an ongoing way. And after death, that sometimes needs to be in new ways, maybe through the creation of new rituals. So we're talking about remembering as more than just a cognitive process. It's actually a performed process that's actually lived out rather than just being something that happens sort of inside your head.
It's a really important point because the conventional grief psychology has created space for people to have kind of a private reminiscence. Or private remembrance of people. We have these remembering experiences at a memorial, And that is a very passive process, often a very private and individual process. And what we would advocate for is a far more dramatic and active folding of a person's membership status back into the affiliations of one's life.
I mean, it's worth noticing that some of the series of stages that people go through in grief are all about the individual. They're not about groups of people or communities.
Mm-hmm. I know, John, in your book you talk about your very young daughter who died. And I was wondering about, when I was reading that part, I was wondering about how we remember pre-verbal humans, you know, pre-verbal children. How do we remember them? Because they wouldn't have all the sayings that we have about Papa in my family.
Right. Yeah. Well, when my daughter died, I went through a terrible time of missing and of thinking over and over again thoughts that were really difficult to handle, along the lines of, I'm not going to see her grow up and go to school and have friends and form a career and make relationships and things like that. And I felt tormented by those kind of ideas for a long time. And it was quite a while before I started to realize that those were the aspects of a life that I had imagined that I would get to enjoy with her and didn't get to happen when she died. But what we all carry whenever a child is born all kinds of ideas about what we imagine the child's life's going to be, and of course as time goes by they don't quite fit the thing we imagine. They assert their own lives and become their own person. And we kind of gradually learn to understand that. And the same is true after Julia died, because what's happened for me since those early days was that I started to realize that there were connections that I was starting to make with other people that would not have been possible without her life and her death. And, you know, I started to share her with people and her story, and found that I had made connections with many other people who had similar kinds of things happen to them in their lives. And I started to think of it in a different way, that, you know, in a way she was introducing me to more people. And in this sense, she was continuing to make things possible in my life that wouldn't have otherwise been the case. So in that sense, she has contributed and continues to contribute to my life, even as I talk about her right now. She has, if you like, a life that is ongoing through story or through narrative about her that is different from the one that I would have planned, but it's the one that has evolved. And as I embrace that, I find that actually much more sustaining and a much more invigorating way to think about her, rather than thinking about what I'm just missing all the time.
Oh, that's wonderful. The next question I have is, I'm sure, one that all of those clinicians who are listening to us right now are thinking, and that is, not everyone has positive memories about dead relatives. How do you do counseling with people who've suffered at the hands of someone in their lives? How do you do that?
Right. And this is one of the things that really needs to be tended to when we're talking about remembering conversations, because we're not advocating for the idealization of a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
You know, our experience as counselors is that most relationships exist, have multiple stories with them. You know, that they may include some aspects that are good, they may include some aspects that are not so good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after a person dies, we don't want to selectively say, well, we're only going to remember the aspects that are good,
mm-hmm.
right? That we want to make sense out of multiple stories of the relationship. And my experience has been that death provides the opportunity for the living to kind of re-examine where a person wants that relationship to fit in that membership club, if we want to stay with that metaphor for a minute. So regardless of whether or not we have a relationship that has been highly estranged for a long time, that person's death is still going to prompt the living person to say, you know, how do I want this person to be in my life? So a lot of times we might see somebody who has not talked to their estranged father for 25 years, after being abused by them, right? And then they find out that, that he passes and that they have, you know, a surprising emotional reaction to them as they're revisiting where do I want that relationship to exist in my life. Now, when we work with that idea of membership, that we can sometimes make very active choices, and John and I would support this, about what position or what rank we want a person to hold in a membered club, right? And so in the event that a relationship has been challenging or troubled or abusive, that we may support people as they create some kind of provisional status in that membership club, right? So that a membership status can be downgraded, right? And that it can be downgraded in death just like it can in life.
Mm-hmm.
I would not actually advocate for very often for the dismissing or cutting off of a relationship because that often seems very harsh to me. That I'd be looking more at, you know, can we set that connection aside and maybe visit it in 5 years from now or maybe visit it in 20 years from now, because we don't know whether there might be some nuggets that we want to farm still at that time. And we might be talking about that living person's resiliency in response to the abuse as something that we want to farm that re-examines the context of the relationship, right? Mm.
Yeah, I love that, making it positive by talking about the victim or the survivor's resiliency. That's a wonderful way to look at it. And John, did you want to add anything there?
Yeah, what I was just thinking was when people are alive, our relationships with them are not, you know, one-sided. They're a mix of things. We kind of have, in our relationships, have a range of different responses to, you know, other people's actions or words, and that is no different after somebody dies. We don't have to have a monological, single hued response to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even people who have been abusive have also had aspects of their interactions with people that are not non-abusive, that are more worthy of remembering. And after someone dies, there's a shift that I think sometimes can take place, which is that the person who is living has an enlarged say in the relationship. They can have more of a shaping influence, more agency in the design of the relationship from there on. And they can choose sometimes to emphasize the things that they want to remember and choose to downplay the things that they choose not to remember about somebody. And the other person is in in a position where they're less able to influence that choice. So people sometimes have... Or object to it, yeah.
Mm, right. Mm.
So sometimes people find new opportunities after someone's died to kind of reshape a relationship in ways that actually are more constructive for them.
We may have a bereaved person who has been in a situation where the relationship has been very troubled with the person who has died, and as they reshape that relationship after death, they may choose other people that they can bring closer to develop those preferred identities.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it create more distance with the person who has died who is difficult,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I was a very young counselor, I would also often use the empty chair technique with Gestalt, and it was interesting because, you know, at first I thought, when I first learned about it, I thought, how are they going to really remember what that person was like? But it was amazing how they could, you know.
Mm.
So you could say, your mother's sitting there, and now you're going to talk to your mother. There's an empty chair, and just remember how she looked. And often I would look at the client, and, you know, I'd see them, as they remember, just start, you know, crying, or their face, you know, was very different. And so that's an interesting kind of...
I would say that all of us have that capability, that we live mm-hmm. with those memories of people as internalized conversations within us, you know, and that they're always accessible to us because they're with us all the time. And so, you know, if we were to do empty chair work, for example, that it's easy for most people to get a sense of their deceased loved one, even if their loved one died 30 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
That connection and those places that have lived with us have not diminished.
And also the gestalt idea of unfinished business, that, you know, that we could actually maybe do some of that with the person we're remembering.
Yes, although I would actually challenge that idea that you know, that the business is ever actually finished. I think life is just ongoing business, and that doesn't stop when somebody dies. It just keeps on going.
Good point.
I just want to add in something else there, and that is that we've talked about and explored and wrote about the concept of the subjunctive voice. This is the kind of almost lost aspect in the English language of kind of speaking in the grammar of as if, you know, when we use words like what somebody would say or might do or could perhaps think, or, you know, those kinds of words. And we just find it really useful sometimes to ask those kinds of questions. Just to give an example, I remember once a conversation with a man whose father had died when he was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And the day after I was talking with him, he was going to his daughter's graduation. This was some, you know, 40 years later. And I asked the question, what would it mean to your father if he could be present at his granddaughter's graduation? And, you know, that was totally subjunctive. I mean, what it would mean to the father was kind of totally imagined and as if. It was a constructed memory, if you like, not a memory of one that happened a long time ago. But it was intensely moving and very, very important for that man to be able to have that kind of link. And it restored something that was kind of not possible in real life, but it could happen in the world of as if. And so I think those kind of questions are very, very powerful. They're not the present, or even the past. They're about an imagined future in that world of as if, the world of the subjunctive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the imagined world then can become the reality in shaping our actions, our feelings, like what I was talking about when I'm asking questions in the presence of a person's deceased loved one, right?
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, what would she want you to do at this minute can help give us sometimes the courage to put one foot in front of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Those subjunctive questions sort of like a bridge between the real world and what can be realized, if you like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking of children, and I'm wondering, is counseling based on remembering practices suitable? Is that suitable for children?
Most definitely suitable, and children go quite easily into the world of the subjunctive with us, that they oftentimes don't have those layers of saying, well, this is not real, so, you know, I can't engage in that kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. My experience has been that children find this very comforting, that in the face of death, that they can continue to find places where their loved one can be near to them. You know, particularly if I'm talking to kids whose sibling has just died or whose parent has just died, and I'm asking them about, you know, what would your mom or your dad want you to remember about them, you know?
Mm.
What kinds of things would you be doing? You know, what kinds of things would you be holding on to? And it gives them, a lifeline as opposed to, okay, they're dead, they're gone, say goodbye.
Mm.
Is very traumatic for children. Mm. There's one little girl I was talking to years ago who, right after her mom died, she was about 10 when I met her and her mom, and right after her mom died, she came into my office and she had on these huge tennis shoes, and they obviously were not her shoes because they were way too big for her feet. And I said, tell me about your shoes, because, yeah, I mean, they were just so obvious. And she said that they were her mom's running shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about what it meant for her to have her mom's shoes on, guiding every step she took as the day went on,
mm-hmm.
and what her mom would say about that, and how that was a place of comfort for her, as opposed to, okay, your mom's dead, get rid of the items, it's not helpful, you're obviously denying the fact that she's dead by wearing the shoes, right? Mm-hmm. Which would be much more of a conventional model that, we would object to. And instead looking at, you know, where is she going to continue to live? Where is she going to guide you, not just now when you're 10, but when you're 15, when you're 20, when you're 50, you know? That those places that kids really find vitally important to them.
One of the things I love about your book is that I think it completely negates the need to get over it, move on, all of those things that we say to people after a certain period of time. Okay, it's been a year now, you should be over this, you know, that kind of thing. It really, gives a person license to continue having a relationship with a departed person. And I just love that. It's very different and just fantastic, in my opinion. One of the things I've also thought about, I wanted to ask you about children, but I also wanted to ask you about groups. Have you used this approach in group counseling? And if so, how has that gone?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
We have
yes,
used it in group counseling.
And it went well.
It was great. One of the things, I would pick up on what you were just saying, Rebecca, mm-hmm. about one of the things, I have run maybe 100 groups using remembering practices as the base of the group. And one of the things that we really focus on in one of the sessions of the groups is exactly what you're saying, is what kind of messages have you been told about how you should act, how you should think, mm-hmm. how you should feel that have been helpful and not helpful. Mm-hmm. And it helps people to kind of deconstruct some of that traditional discourse around the way people should behave with grief. A group format is very purposeful and very helpful for remembering conversations in that it builds an immediate audience where, and it kind of a new membership club, if you will, where those stories can be tried on for size, where you can actively reshape the connection with the loved one in a place that feels trusting and safe because other people have been living with that, where you can develop rituals that will carry you forward and create a sense of strength and agency. I just actually finished my dissertation on this topic, on how remembering conversations are very, very useful and very applicable into group settings. And I think it's an exciting new place for remembering conversations to take shape and live.
And one thing I love about any kind of group that I've led over the years is that you don't feel alone. That's one of the things you get when you go to group therapy, is you don't have to feel alone in whatever it is you're dealing with. Yeah.
And I would certainly add that about remembering conversations, is that part of the remembering practice is we don't want the bereaved person to feel alone. If we mm-hmm. want that the voice of the deceased person living alongside of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we multiply that in the group, and we have, you know, hundreds of voices available.
Absolutely. And, John, did you want to add anything about group?
Yeah, I was just going to add that with some students who've been working in schools, we've just recently published an article in the Journal of School Counseling about using remembering groups in school context. And young people in sort of middle school, high school ages have found these very, very helpful and invigorating. And one little aspect that our students creatively developed was that they kind of worked with the kids to kind of make some kind of drawing, some artwork, some kind of collage work, using pictures of the dead loved ones, and kind of making the stories concreted in that way, mm-hmm. and then shrunk them down on a photocopier and laminated them and made little membership cards. So the concept of membership was concretized into a sense of membership cards, and these kids often would carry these membership club cards around as little daily kind of reminders of their connection with the person who had died, and they often found this quite comforting.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very creative little way of doing it, but it's an example of how, you know, not just with adults but also with young people, group work can be very powerful and very effective and helpful.
some of the, we will put that link on our website, because there will, among all of the counselors who will be listening to this, some will be school counselors, so it would be wonderful to pass that on to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to also mention that I lived on the Big Island of Hawaii for a year. I was the administrator of a counseling agency, and you know, in Hawaii, there was always this concept of what they call talking story. So they would say, so we would have, we would be having our supervision group, and different counselors would talk, and I, you know, we would say, well, how are you doing with this client? And they would say, oh, all he wants to do is talk story all the time. And people in Hawaii, it was something that was completely understood. You know, this person wants, they just want to, they want to tell you stories. And it was usually very positively regarded. And I think of this concept of talking story as maybe being a part of this remembering. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm thinking about Michael White's idea about folk psychology, about how psychology is actually, westernized psychology is actually removed people from their personal knowledges or their talking stories.
Mm-hmm.
I love that idea, what you just shared about Hawaii, and that part of narrative work and part of remembering conversations is about the restoration of personal knowledges or folk psychology. Or, you know, if we want to break, you know, that word restoration down, it's about the restoring of what's helpful, the knowledges we know about ourselves, you know, our local rituals, our family customs, those kinds of things. That are far more sustaining than knowing what a diagnosis might be, you know, as we face a difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
I can just add to that, too. I think Michael White you know, developed that idea and borrowed it a little bit from Jerome Bruner, who talked about folk psychology quite a lot. And, I mean, Bruner's kind of point was that I think modern psychology has often dismissed kind of local indigenous psychologies as being not as good as scientific psychology,
right,
and in the process has separated people from resources that might be actually very helpful in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
This includes, as you say, kind of cultural resources, and I'm very familiar with the, coming from New Zealand, with the oral traditions and Polynesian cultures in general.
Yeah.
So talking story fits, you know, within those traditions.
Mm-hmm.
But many other cultures have those kind of traditions as well, have their own traditions of where people can find places of help and sustenance in the face of death, for example. And rather than, you know, apply models that are derived from psychological science, we might often much more helpfully ask people, you know, where in your own cultural world, in your own religion, in your own family culture, the ideas, the traditions, the sayings, the rituals, the practices that actually can help sustain you through the painful period that does occur after somebody dies. And I think, you know, therapy that actually helps connect people to things that sustain them and invigorate them
mm-hmm.
is really important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wanted to, as we draw to a close, I wanted to give each of you the opportunity of giving us some closing remarks. And what I want to say to you is that your audience, the listeners to this podcast, most of them will be practicing counselors all over the United States and other countries. What do you want to say to them about your book, about your work? And whoever wants to go first, give us some parting words.
John, you want to go ahead and go first?
Okay. I guess, you know, it's actually quite a simple move to talk to people who are suffering from the bereavement of someone that they loved, to say, instead of saying, tell me about the pain,
mm-hmm.
tell me about the person.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how you are related to that person, what memories you have of them. And that's not a difficult shift to make.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I think, other practices of remembering that can grow upon that initial shift.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a profound shift. Too much, I think, of of grief counseling has focused on asking people to talk about the emotions that go with the loss.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not wanting to say that we don't need to speak about those, but that doesn't need to be our only focus, and it doesn't necessarily need to be the primary focus, because what we talk about often gets magnified. If we talk about what is painful, we may magnify the pain. If we talk about what is sustaining and invigorating, we may magnify that and grow connection with that. And I think we have a responsibility as counselors and therapists to actually work with people to do work that is that grows their sense of strength and agency and ability to actually, you know, design their own lives in constructive ways. And to me, that's what remembering conversations are about. I'd also add, by the way, just quickly, that remembering conversations may be very useful in other forms of counseling as well, not just when someone has died and they're experiencing grief. But the voices of dead loved ones can be called in to support other identity projects or other struggles people are having with other things, other problems in their lives. And I think it's important to recall that the voices of those who we care about who are no longer alive often have particular poignancy and particular places of honor in our lives, and therefore they can be called on for all kinds of purposes, not just in getting through the period of grief.
Yes, that's a wonderful point. Thank you so much for that. And Lorraine, any parting words you would like to say to us?
Well, I would echo the words that John just said as very important as well. And I think what I was reflecting on, Rebecca, is that what you had said earlier, that remembering conversations does represent a paradigm shift in mm-hmm. how we think of, about death and grief. And for me, that there is a political element in it of no longer silencing the voices of the dead mm-hmm. and giving them a platform to speak from. I think it is critically important in how we shape some of those identity stories. I would also want to invite the counselors who are listening just to experiment with some of this and see how it fits for them. So they might want to experiment with their clients just with some very, very simple questions and notice what the effect is, right? Mm-hmm. Or they may want to, tonight around the dinner table, tell one story about somebody in their own lives that has passed. And notice what the effect is for them, you know, on how that impacts on their lives, and is it a useful place for them to go. So I would just, offer that space of invitation to try it and see how it unfolds.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I want to thank you so much, John Winslade and Lorraine Hedke, for joining us to discuss your book, Remembering Lives, Conversations with the Dying and Bereaved. I appreciate you both being here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Okay. To view links to this program or to write to the presenter or the presenters or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Danielberg, your host for the ACA 2010 podcast series, signing off.